Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, and today we're continuing our trip around the world to start off the new year and the new decade. Today, I talk with Megan Johnson from Breaking Banks Europe in Berlin about the state of fintech and innovation across Europe, both pre- and post-Brexit. Brett was in China along with Jim Marus last week, and they're going to share some scenes from Shenzhen, a city that moves at a dizzying pace. They took a private tour of Huawei Technologies, were provided exclusive access to executives from Ping An Financial Services, WeLab, Alibaba, and WeBank, and you can read more about it in Jim's headline article in the Financial Brand this week, where, as he put it, the future of banking has arrived.
So Shenzhen is one of the most innovative cities in the world today. It sits on the border of mainland China and Hong Kong, but it exists as a special economic zone for China. And so it has always grown up, or has grown up over the last 30, 40 years, being dedicated to exceptional sort of engineering and growth, and a very different approach from general parts of China. Jim Marus and I have been visiting Shenzhen this week, talking to executives at Huawei and some of the leading companies in Shenzhen about some of the innovation that's taking place here. We're with Meng Ting right now, who is with Huawei's communications team. So Meng Ting, can I ask you a little bit about, can you describe for people what Shenzhen is like as a city? How many people live here? And what sort of city is Shenzhen? Because for people that don't know about it.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So Shenzhen is in the southern part of China. It's located within the Guangdong province. And about half of the people here, they speak Cantonese. So until 2018, it has a population of around 13 million people. And for the GDP in 2018, it has around $366 billion. So Shenzhen in China is famous for its technological development, its innovation, and the spirit of trying and doing experiments in terms of economy. So in 1980, pushed by the Mr. Deng Xiaoping, China's first special economic zone, Shenzhen, was founded. And after that, Mr. Deng also visited Shenzhen twice. Since 1999, China's the high level of high tech conference was held in Shenzhen as well. So in 2016, the GDP of Shenzhen has exceeded the Guangzhou province, and it ranks number 3 in China in general. So Shenzhen is one of the most important cities in the southern part of China, and it's a birthplace of a lot of technology companies and internet companies. Now it's leading the China in becoming the tech-led oriented country and tech-led industry in the world as well.
So if you're not familiar with Shenzhen, you may recognize some of the companies that are here. DJI is one of the biggest drone companies in the world, at least from a retail consumer perspective. They're based here in Shenzhen. Of course, we have Tencent has a large headquarters here. Tencent WeBank and WeChat, most of the innovations that appear in the financial services space related to Tencent have happened here out of Shenzhen. Huawei, of course, has a massive presence here. We've been visiting the Huawei campus and the R&D center today, where they have a combined population of about 40,000 of their R&D and engineering staff. Huawei has 96,000 R&D staff just operating here locally in China. So maybe Mengting, can you explain for me the relationship between or why Huawei has such a strong base here in Shenzhen?
Yeah, I think the question is twofold. On one hand, Shenzhen, as the first special economic zone, it provided the perfect environment for a tech company to develop and to absorb resources, because the Shenzhen government, in order to motivate and incentivize these companies to become more independent and to have their own technological development, we have a lot of tax like benefits and the land use benefits from the government. So in this sense, the government has created a perfect environment for these companies to grow, and it has a relatively free like environment, less restrictions on these companies itself. But on the other hand, I think after maybe a decade of Huawei's foundation and its the founding of its headquarters in Shenzhen, Huawei in turn has led the economic growth of Shenzhen as well. I think it's one of the biggest taxpayers in for Shenzhen government and even for the Chinese government, and it has also boosted local economy in the Longgang district.
It's a fairly young city as well, isn't it? There's a lot of young people here in Shenzhen.
Yeah, I heard that, and like I read an article, it said that the average age of Shenzhen people and Shenzhen residents is 30 years old. Yeah, so it's quite young. And a lot of young people, like in the past, most graduates in Beijing, they would choose to stay in Beijing and find a job there. But recently, a growing number of students are going to Shenzhen or other places in Guangdong to find their career and join these internet or technology companies as well.
So Huawei is one of the fastest growing companies in China, obviously. So how do you, like with 96,000 engineers in the research and development side, how do you continue to fuel that growth? Where do all the people come from?
Mm-hmm. So Mr. Yuan, like our president, the Huawei has insisted that we need new blood into this company, and this is one key of our success. So on the one hand, the company has developed special human resources policies and competitive salaries to attract these young graduates. And secondly, it provides a lot of platforms and opportunities for these engineers or those students majoring in social sciences like me to find their path and career in this company as well. And also thirdly, I think it has encouraged some the experienced staff to transfer their skills and to teach the young generation to grow faster. So the environment in Huawei for new employees is quite encouraging.
How would you compare Shenzhen as a city to live in compared with a city like Beijing or Shanghai?
First of all, the air quality is much better than Beijing, which is a big concern. But I think Shenzhen and Shanghai are similar in the sense that they are both young and they are both energetic, but Beijing is more like a political and a cultural center of China. But the three cities, they have the same problems, city problems, such as large population and fast pace of living. But in general, I feel that Shenzhen is a better place for young people to live in and to figure out which trajectory they are trying to do in the end. And also, if you are interested in technology and innovation, Shenzhen definitely has more companies suitable for you than Beijing especially.
Now, how does Huawei create a culture that's positive for its employees? You talked about some of the working flexibility and things like that. So what are some of the initiatives that Huawei has put in place to improve the quality, the working life for your employees?
Yes, as we said, we have a flexible working time. And also, if you work late, after 8:30 p.m., we have free food. You can use that at breakfast or you can eat that immediately. It's a great package. Also, I think for like young employees like me, the biggest problem or like the biggest motivation for me would not be on the material side. It would more be the long-term development trajectory and the opportunities. So Huawei, as one of the biggest recruiters and the corporate in China, it has exposed me to international opportunities. I can work in another office, and also I can have internal arrangements. For example, if I don't feel I fit into the current position, I can apply and take the interviews and be transferred to another department, as long as that department accepts me. So I think it gives me a certain degree of flexibility and also opportunity to figure out what I actually am interested in and am good at.
I'm also here with Jay Kemp, who's the president of Provoke Management, the speaker agency that manages Jim, myself, Dave Birch, and a number of other fintech specialists. So, Jay, give me your impressions of what the Huawei campus was like. What flavor, from a design perspective, did you see there?
Well, I've never, I mean, you've traveled a lot more than I have, but I've never seen anything like it. It's modeled after European towns. It looked identical to many of the buildings that I've seen in Europe, except they were cleaner. It seemed like a lot of happy people there, motivated and incentivized to work. It was spectacular. If you ever get a chance to come to Shenzhen, I would certainly come see that campus.
And they had KFC.
And they have KFC.
Yeah.
So the Huawei campus was pretty unique. It covers a couple of square kilometers in terms of a couple of square miles in terms of its total land mass. But they have accommodation for the staff as well, right?
Right. I saw high-rise apartment buildings that I think house 10,000 employees. And you can, if I'm correct, you can apply to live there.
Yeah.
And for a young person, I think I couldn't think of a better situation to be in. So,
we also visited the factory floor. Can you tell us a little bit about the factory we saw with the production facility? They were producing the Huawei P30 phone at the time, right?
Yes. So we visited a manufacturing production line today, which is a small portion, proportional of our whole like manufacturing lines. So it's producing P30 with all the automated machines and the machines to double check the quality of each process. So for that part, we opened this to all of our customers and also media to show the transparency and openness of our manufacturing process. Also, it manifests the technological innovation of Huawei, because some machines we actually assemble them by ourselves, and some of them we have patent in them. So that machine line, for example, it has gone through a lot of improvements. Some of the improvements are initiated by the employees themselves. We have a special all designed to put all the like employees and their small innovations and inventions in that place to encourage them to become more open-minded and dedicated to their work. So we have when the production line was firstly produced, it took about 60 people to produce one phone, and they need to stand there and wait for the whole process to be finished. And now, because of computing and automation, it only takes 16 people, and it produces one P30 around within 30 seconds.
Yeah, 28.5 seconds,
yeah.
I think.
Yes, that's quite accurate.
So those improvements you talk about, we saw pictures of staff against the wall. Could you explain what those pictures were for?
Yes. So that all is designed for whoever has made any kind of improvement to make this manufacturing process more efficient and cheaper. For example, one person, like, they reduced the time to collect the phones by using a little robot. So that reduces this process by 3 seconds. So this all shows collective efforts from the individuals that can make a massive impact in the end, because considering how many phones we need to make per day and how 3 seconds can make a difference in the end by accumulating them.
Now, this innovative culture, this engineering sort of view of the world, that's not uncommon to find in Shenzhen, is it? We're on our way right now to the big technology mall. So tell us about the culture of innovation that exists in Shenzhen as a city.
Yeah, so when Shenzhen was firstly chosen as a place to do the innovation and to do the reforming and the opening up. Its mission was to just try it and see how it goes. And it broke the steam system of planet economy, and from the center to the bottom, and from a bottom-up perspective, Shenzhen was a lab that is full of risky choices and the spirit of not being afraid of doing something wrong. So from the beginning, Shenzhen has some special cultural and political and even social meanings attached to it. It is a city where there are a lot of entrepreneur spirit, and also a lot of young people come here and they test out their ideas without being carried with a lot of burden of being doing something wrong. Yeah, so I think it is in this exact culture that Shenzhen has cultivated a lot of tech companies and internet companies like Tencent and Huawei.
Jim, can I ask you about your impressions of the Huawei campus and the production line we saw?
You know, you get an idea of what the future may be, but it was interesting at the Huawei European inspired campus that immediately you're transformed almost into the past while being in the future. And I think the thing that was most amazing, it had a Disney-like feel from the standpoint of everything was like the train connecting the different regions of Europe. There's 12 regions that represent it. It's built with the intention of some point employing 25,000 people. So basically, you have 12 regions of Europe that are going to house a city of employees, all from the R&D sector. So you have all these things hitting you, almost like sensory overload. And what was amazing is this entire 3.5 square mile campus has been built in 5 years.
Yeah.
So the speed, the technology, the perfection of it. I mean, there was art everywhere, structural, sculptures and different kinds of art. And the thought to detail. You looked at everything and you said there wasn't a piece missing from the gardens and the topography to the feel of the buildings. And then we went to the factory where the cell phones, the mobile phones were being manufactured. And the first thing that struck you was you're looking down multiple manufacturing lines, each manufacturing their own phone or whatever it may be, 13 employees. From 85 to 13 employees on that line.
Every 29 seconds.
Right. And at a point where the employees were actually motivated, self-motivated, to continually improve the process. And some of the improvements we saw that were most interesting was the fact that gravity itself helped move the production line along because it made it so they could move at the pace of the phones and the employee as opposed to being imposed by manufacturing or by machines, which as you looked at it, you initially thought, well, it's interesting how this works, but then you realize this allows the employee to actually dictate the speed at which the entire production line runs. But they do produce 2,400 of the phones that we saw manufactured in a day. So not a bad process.
Now, I've been coming to China since 99. The first time I visited Shenzhen was in 2001. And so I've had a great deal of exposure and seen the city double in size and grow during that time. And it's an incredible city. I'm always a big fan of that sort of innovation culture that's here. But, you know, for most Americans, they have not seen this side of China. They're not aware of what goes on here. And they sort of think of China as the factory of the world. And, you know, they think about the copyright issues of three decades ago and things like that. But this is your first visit to China, and this is one of the most innovative cities in the world. So as an American coming from that system, what's it like? How do you perceive China in that context of sort of global commerce and competitiveness based on the experience you've seen in Shenzhen today?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been fortunate over the last 5 years to travel the world and see things that I never have seen before. And take them in within context of where I'm going. Coming to China, from my first time in this deep into China, I wasn't sure what to expect, but immediately, the first day we were here, we saw their technology innovation amphitheater, I'll call it, and it showed us different ways that the Huawei technology is being deployed in the world, from smart cities to smart infrastructure for manufacturing facilities to smart and good solar grids.
And the Atlas chip, the embedded AI chip.
Yeah, which is much smaller than the palm of my hand. And you go, this has more power in it than anything I've probably gotten that close to, even to the degree where you had mainframe computer systems that can fit in a compartmental, you know, a back end of a semi and be dropped anywhere and instantaneously plug and play. When you look at that...
Well, a complete data center, really, in a shipping container.
Exactly. And one that was self-contained, even from a stability of environment standpoint. We walked through it, and you saw what the future is. And as you looked at this, one of the questions I asked one of the people that are doing the tour was, you know, is this in place anywhere? They go, you're seeing it in place. So you're seeing Shenzhen, and we saw an example of an auto accident that immediately got censored, and immediately the deployment of emergency response vehicles based on the type of accident was and what happened in the accident to know not only what has to be deployed to take care of it, how traffic can be diverted, good sound effects in the background for that, how traffic can be diverted, how the hospital can be notified to be ready, and even to the degree where families can be notified. You know, one of the interesting stories they told us is that as soon as they put some of these smart city components in place in the cameras, they were able to look and find people that were not buckling their seatbelts. Now, that was not used as a penalty, but when they notified the driver, by the way, we saw that you're not putting on your seatbelts, they saw a complete ramp up of the usage of seatbelts. Now, when we talk about how bad...
That's using image recognition, right?
And when we talk about how bad technology or innovation or watching us can be, this is another example of how it can save lives, how it can change the way we handle our lives for the better. And, you know, in the U.S., we're talking about smart cities. We're usually talking about, oh, how can we keep traffic moving effectively? Here, it was, how can we save lives? How can we make it so the power structure can be replicated and can be diverted if something goes down in an area? How can we make it so that life doesn't stop because old technology possibly can't handle it? It's been an amazing trip from the perspective of seeing some of the old, seeing some of the new, but more importantly, seeing the solutions. It wasn't technology we saw. We saw how these technologies are being deployed. And I think, as we talked about earlier today, I think the takeaway is that we can't, as people, hope that this change goes away or it's not having to be implemented going forward. There's so much that can be done.
It's the middle of January right now, and it's that time where it can be tough to keep those New Year's resolutions going. To eat healthier, get to the gym more often, get your finances in order. But here's a resolution that's actually easy to keep. Earn more money. The Wealthfront Cash Account makes it effortless to earn more on your savings so you can keep that one going all year long. With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.78% annual percentage yield. That's 18 times more interest than the national average of 0.1%, according to Bankrate.com. It only takes $1 and a few minutes to open an account, and you can even do it right from your phone with no paperwork required. There are no fees, and your money is FDIC insured for up to $1 million through their partner banks. Wealthfront's clients trust them with over $22 billion, and those clients have earned over $70 million in interest with their Wealthfront cash accounts. Wealthfront is the ideal way to manage your money. You can save, plan, invest, and get financial advice all in one place, and they make your money work harder for you, and that's a resolution worth keeping. Right now, you can sign up for a Wealthfront cash account in less than 5 minutes by visiting wealthfront.com/fintech. Go to wealthfront.com/fintech and start earning 18 times more interest on all your savings. That's wealthfront.com/fintech. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change.
Well, we've been walking around Shenzhen. We caught up with, we went into the AI and IoT mall. So, Jim, What do you think about this mall?
It's a toy land for adults. I mean, you end up having electronic sensor massagers. You end up having computer components. We bought a few drones. Robots were talking to us. It was pretty crazy.
So, you know, it sort of really feels like this is a really technology-based city, right?
Yeah, you realize that as an adult, you go, everything needs a battery. Everything's electronic, but the dynamics of the going further, one of the times I was here, first time I was here in China, we were all looking at cameras. Right. It was actual, regular cameras and video cameras and video machines. This stuff's gone so much further. The technology, the ability to make things move, to make things help us. I mean, the massagers were kind of crazy with electronic sensors that went through your body and give you a massage without vibrating.
What about the electronic components we saw on reels, plastic reels?
Yeah, and what it was what you're looking at in the Huawei factory earlier today. But you can buy it and build your own phone. So if you knew how to do
from
it,
scratch,
you could make it from scratch, exactly.
And drone engines and drone bodies and remote control gear, everything you can think of from an electronic component perspective, right?
Oh, and you know, this whole area, not just the mall, but the entire street here is all filled with electronic components, phones, anything you wanted from a gear standpoint, you have it here.
How would you describe this compared with, say, Times Square or something similar?
Well, you have fewer restaurants and a whole lot more toys.
And how big do you think this area is? It must stretch at least a mile.
Yeah, it's Broadway with all the, the technology, all the big screen TVs, but instead of being more like, they're all LED, so they're all high def all the way along the road, and it's pretty amazing. Huawei is well represented along the whole road, though.
Absolutely, with DJI and Apple and so forth. And of course, we're just passing a police station here where you can use facial recognition to apply for a visa to Hong Kong. And it just takes a couple of minutes, but it uses facial recognition. And what's the restaurant we can see up here on the left, dear?
Let's see. Is that Starbucks? We can see it. We have a Starbucks up here.
Yeah, the one over here.
Probably a KFC.
KFC.
We see a few KFCs. KFCs are well represented in almost any country we go to.
And of course, you can walk into the KFC and you can buy your KFC chicken using facial payments, right?
Yeah, everything's facial payments. And we also, in one of the stores, we saw one of those translators where the girl didn't speak English. She was speaking Chinese into the translator and then it was playing back to us in English.
So this was in a shop with robots that people are buying to promote their business and restaurants and stuff like that. But it was a real-time translation in a little handheld unit like a smartphone.
Yeah, and the cost was extraordinarily low compared to what most of these components, most of this gear would cost at home.
So when you walk through this mall or whatever we're going to call it, this streetscape here with all these amazing electronic stores, LED and neon lights everywhere, drones and phones and computers. What impression does this give you about Shenzhen as a city?
Well, it's certainly modern. And I think what's interesting, again, comparing it to when I came to China way in the past, first time I was ever here, everything's modernized. The people are modernized. They're all using tech as they're walking. And it's not as crowded as I expected. I mean, it's a good-sized crowd, but everybody's buying something.
And so you don't feel like this is a developing economy anymore, right?
No, and the safety value too. There's no place you go here. There's people all around trying to help you. They're very helpful. And you look and you see the Chinese flags and you realize, oh, that's right. I'm not at home anymore.
Yeah. So it's pretty special. Hey, Jay, tell me about your impression of Shenzhen from coming to the mall here.
It's a combination of Times Square and your favorite shopping mall, like your high-end shopping malls, but it's just big and there's so much here. And I don't know, I've never seen anything like this.
What does this tell you about Shenzhen in terms of innovation, do you think?
Well, I was just speaking to our Huawei friends and it's like, it's just so much, like every Westerner should come here. Yeah. And see this, and it's just so, I had such a different impression coming into this and seeing it now, and And these guys are so far ahead of us in innovation and their attitude toward innovation, and they're motivated to every employee, you know, from whatever level they are, they're motivated to help the company succeed and help the city succeed. It's just something I've never seen before.
And I know you and I are a bit older, but this feels like a young city too, right?
Very young city, yeah. Like, we're the old guys. But it's a very young city, but everyone's very nice. They're not suppressed, and it's your typical Western view of what China is. It's completely wrong, like I said.
Would you come back to Shenzhen based on your visit here?
I've already been invited back. So have you.
Awesome.
Yes. Certainly I would.
So if you had a chance to meet someone who didn't know a lot about China, how would you describe China today from your Shenzhen experience?
I would say it's just something you need to experience, and it's not like the Western. I just think the Western impression of what China is completely wrong, and it's a very vibrant city with happy people, and
would you agree with my assessment? This feels like one of the most innovative cities in the world.
It's innovative. Oops. For sure. It's innovative. But it's very energetic too, and you can feel the vibe. You can feel the energy as you're walking around. You could feel it all day today when we were touring Huawei and the R&D department, and you could see it in the eyes of the employees. It's a very energized and motivated city.
Thanks very much. So that's it from on the ground in Shenzhen at the massive technology mall. Space, and just looking around, you see 5G signs everywhere. We see Oppo here, Huawei, DJI, Samsung, Apple, Kentucky Fried Chicken, all these major technology brands and big brands. It's a happening place. I hope you all get the chance to come and visit.
Well, it's time to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Well, I'm here with Megan Johnson. Megan is a fintech researcher, a customer journey expert, a strategy consultant specializing in UX and design, and maybe most importantly, part of our team at Breaking Banks Europe. And as we continue to head towards what seems more and more likely like a post-Brexit Europe, I want to talk with her a little bit about what that means for London and some of the other leading business centers across Europe. So, Megan, welcome to the show. And, you know, you've had something of a personal Brexit yourself over the last couple of years. After spending several years in London, you've moved to Berlin.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's I'm super happy to kind of share my insights, having spent the first part of my career on the London side of things, and now I've been in Berlin for a little over 2 years. I kind of had my own weird reverse Brexit type thing, and it's amazing to see how quickly Berlin is taking off as a hub for innovation and everything digital, really. I think it's great seeing the breadth of startups here. So there's a lot of startups within, you know, mobility and health and wellness, in addition to fintech and payments, and of course, cryptocurrency and blockchain. So I think it's good to kind of be able to see everything with this, holistic view.
Yeah. So what drove that change for you from London to Berlin?
I lived in London for 7.5 years. I got a British passport and I just kind of wanted to move to a city that was a bit more quieter, had a, you know, better quality of living, cheaper beer, more green space. Just kind of a different star, kind of, I guess, more in the heart of Europe, because I think, you know, while the UK is certainly part of still the EU, it's definitely a big difference living in London and, you know, mainland Europe.
Well, let's start there relative to fintech. London is the self-proclaimed fintech capital of the world, and for good reason. Lots of good activity, lots of strong government support, strong support from the industry and the regulators and so on. Given your perspective there and what you've seen elsewhere, you know, not just Berlin, but elsewhere in your travels, how is fintech evolving? What's happening? Maybe we'll start with London. What's happening there as we do anticipate this Brexit?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, London definitely, I think, deserves that title of the fintech hub of the world. And I think that, you know, I just kind of want to take a step back. And when you think about London and the UK and other markets in Europe, I think it's important to consider that, you know, there's different inspirational and really innovative things happening in each market, driven by kind of, you know, the nature of financial services, you know, the customers they serve, the regulation. And, you know, I think one of the biggest, most exciting things to be coming out of London is everything surrounded with kind of open banking. You know, I think London is really the leader and at the forefront of open banking initiatives. So I think that, you know, that's certainly something that's quite topical and prominent with London. I think also, you know, when you look at the challenger banks that have come out of London, kind of the Monzos and the Starlings, it's interesting that they're actually expanding and leaving London. So I think Starling is set to expand to Ireland and Monzo moving to the US. So, I mean, I think this seems to be the natural course for the majority of the challenger banks in London and within Europe as well. So kind of establish yourself in the home market and then go abroad. And I know that we'll touch upon the SME space. And I think that's, super prevalent in what I'm seeing with SME banks on mainland Europe.
Well, I definitely want to talk about SME, small to moderate enterprises or small business, SMB, different acronyms, different kind of targets. But yes, something larger than a consumer, but smaller than a major corporation, very unique needs. And I definitely want to talk about that. But I want to stay with London for just a minute. And I talked about the support of the government and regulators. Do you think that's important? And are you seeing that pop up in other cities?
I think London is very unique in that regard. So, you know, the sandbox initiatives to come out of London, you know, years ago has proven an inspiration for all markets around the world. But I mean, I know that in London, when the CMA kind of opened up the market for these challenger banks, you know, they had a team and consultants to actually help, you know, these challenger banks with their application to become a bank. So it's almost as if, you know, they really have done everything in their power to, you know, build up this, you know, creative and unique market in terms of, you know, challenger banks and new fintechs. And I think that's really been a driver, is that I think, you know, the fintechs and the challenger banks have really had the support of the regulators from day one, and they continue to have the support from the regulators. And then, you know, of course, another highly unique aspect of London is everything that's happened with RBS and their huge fund that they, you know, they have to give X amount of money to challenger banks and new fintech. So that's just opened up, you know, a whole pool of funds that these, you know, newer companies desperately need to kind of, you know, expand, build out their products and services, gain more customers, and really compete. So I think those two things have put them in a very unique position. But I mean, of course, I think, you know, what I've really learned from kind of working more in Europe and living in Europe is that each market is you know, very, very different. You know, I think we have some more active, you know, helpful regulators, especially in Scandinavia. If we think about kind of Germany, you know, the BaFin, I think, is a bit more, how do I put it? Less kind of lax and willing to kind of support from the regulatory perspective. You know, I know the folks at Solaris quite well, and I've talked to them about their experience of acquiring the banking license, and it's definitely not as easy in Germany as it is in the UK, and I think that's definitely the result of the regulation.
Well, and I think there's a spectrum, right? There is supportive of innovation and fintechs and earlier stage companies. Then there's maybe not as supportive, and then somewhere way down the other end is, you know, kind of hostile. There are some governments and regulators that really just want to protect the banking system for a handful of licensed banks. Are you seeing that in Europe?
I mean, nothing that appears to be too hostile. I think actually in some markets, thinking about it, it's almost as if some of the big banks have kind of stepped up in place of regulators that really support innovation and kind of, you know, them being seen as the incubators of, you know, fintech and innovation in their markets. So, I mean, immediately what springs to mind are, you know, the BBVAs and the INGs and also the DNBs, you know, where they're partnering, investing in, you know, different fintechs in their markets, running incubators, doing everything to kind of build up their domestic scene, perhaps in place of a, you know, a more forward-thinking regulator.
So kind of being driven from the banks themselves.
Yes, yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, I don't think that there's, I mean, you know, there's what, 27, 28 countries in the EU, and I don't really know the ins and outs of each of them, but I think I know kind of, I have a good enough overview of each market, and, you know, I don't think I've heard of anything where a regulator is, you know, shutting down, you know, a particular fintech or challenger bank or really kind of going after them. I think it's more just how easy are you going to make it for more of these kind of players and easier for them to essentially go to market. So I know, you know, even in Germany, N26, you know, they've gotten in a bit of trouble with the BaFin in terms of AML and KYC with some of their initial customers. You know, Germany, I think, has some of the most stringent KYC criteria here.
So, yeah, and privacy laws.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, in Germany, when I apply for any bank account, I either have to physically go into a branch, go into a post office where someone physically sees me, or I have a video call. So this, you know, kind of interbank authentication or the selfie approach doesn't fly in Germany. And, you know, the BaFin kind of treated N26 like they would with any other bank here. I think it's, you know, and it's going or continuing with kind of the N26 story, I think that it's more their reputation amongst the consumers. And I think, you know, from the consumer perspective, that's definitely another difference between London and the rest of Europe, is that, you know, having lived in London and also in kind of Berlin and traveling to other countries, it seems that consumers in the UK, specifically London, are much more willing to try out a new bank account or service on the whole than some of the other markets.
Well, and that kind of cuts both ways. I mean, over the long run, do you think that's good that maybe the BaFin, which is the German regulator, if you didn't pick up on that acronym, that they're a little more stringent? Do you think that'll be good over the long run, or is it holding back innovation?
I don't think it's holding back innovation. I think because... It's this weird situation because in Germany you have a Solaris, a Fidor, a Wirecard, where you know there's plenty of banks and fintechs here. So Tomorrow, Penta, Contest, in which they can go to market very quickly, and they have you know they're backed by these bank as a service providers. So you know it's like these providers go through the, you know, the challenges, and they take the time and they gain the trust of the BaFin. And then, you know, there's a huge responsibility on them to ensure that their customers are, you know, maintaining the, you know, the same levels of compliance. So I think that, you know, in Germany it works because you do have these bank as a service providers. So I don't feel like innovation is necessarily being held back. I think in a weird way, it's actually helping kind of innovative banks and fintechs in Germany, because you can actually go to market, you know, quite quickly through a Solaris or a Fidor bank. So I'm quite good friends with a lot of the folks at Penta, and I've kind of, you know, seen them, how they've grown, and, you know, what they've been doing has been, you know, they've launched quite quickly because they have had the Solaris to prop them up.
Well, let's stay on Germany for just a second, because at least outside of fintech, Germany, maybe along with Ireland and a couple of other spots, are seem to be maybe the biggest beneficiary of post-Brexit Europe. Yeah. But Germany, between Berlin and Bonn and Frankfurt, there have been a number of centers there. How's that all kind of shaking out within the country?
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, like I said, you know, each market is so unique. And, you know, while in the UK, London is, you know, the fintech and financial service hub. In the Netherlands, you have Amsterdam. Germany's very fragmented. So, you know, the big banks, the traditional banks, all in Frankfurt. You know, in Munich, we have, you know, more of the insurance companies. And in Hamburg, we have trade finance. And Berlin, I would say, would be the majority of these kind of newer players, you know, but I look at kind of Tomorrow Bank, and they're based out of Hamburg, and, you know, there's a few in Munich as well. So there's no hub, which makes it, I don't know, it kind of is a challenge. So, you know, I think about like myself and some people that enjoy living, you know, in Berlin, but... You know, if we wanted to then kind of, you know, jump ship to a larger bank, that would likely mean a relocation to a Frankfurt. And, you know, it geographically, it's a big country. And, you know, because you don't have that hub, I think that we could run into the problem where, you know, certain types of talent are confined to certain cities. And, you know, whether down the line that leads to kind of... that holds back innovation, I'm not entirely sure.
Well, and just maybe one last note on Germany. Greg Palmer's been talking about this on the Finovate podcast, but Finovate Europe moving from also from London to Berlin for the first time, coming up on the 11th through 13th of February.
Yes, yeah, that's really big. And do you know, that's not really... you know, there's a few other fintech and finance events that historically were in other markets and are now taking place in Berlin. So, I mean, I think it's great for Berlin as a hub of fintech and, you know, financial innovation within Germany and within Europe. So,
yeah, but certainly not the only place. So talk a little bit about what's been happening in Scandinavia, particularly around payments, and describe what P27 is.
Yeah, so, I mean, Scandinavia for me has always just been like the poster child for innovation and collaboration. And, you know, independently, the different kind of countries in Scandinavia, so Norway, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, they've been making huge strides in the world of payments. So in Norway, DNB launched an instant payment service called Vipps, which has now been spun off. The major banks in Norway have a stake in Vipps. In Sweden, you have Swish, which came out, I think, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And again, that was a instant P2P, and now it's business payment also solution that was started by the banks. And now, I guess the logical next step in this, great collaboration for a better payment world. The Norwegian banks have come together in a kind of consortium called P27. And what it will do is facilitate instant payments across the Scandinavian markets. So that's, I think, super interesting. And then kind of an aside, but staying on the lines of collaboration and innovation within Scandinavia, each of the markets in Scandinavia, they have these, government-backed ID services. So Norway and Sweden, and you have mobile bank ID, which is kind of, it's a state kind of mechanism for authenticating and identifying yourself, in financial transactions and making tax payments. And we're seeing something similar in Spain. So the majority of the Spanish banks have come together they're hoping to kind of get up and running a blockchain-based identity platform that will make the kind of KYC within banking and other types of services for consumers easier.
Yeah, lots of things happening everywhere. And, Poland, I think, is another one. We've had Michal Panowicz on the show a number of times, and he was one of the architects of, what became MBank. Chris Skinner has moved to Warsaw. So yeah. There are so many things. And as you talk about Scandinavia, it makes me think of the U.S. market of kind of similar with a lot of smaller institutions. And so the need to collaborate and work together.
And just even when you said Warsaw, that kind of reminded me. I mean, even I was just looking, I was reading a blog about kind of up and coming cities in Europe, and Warsaw and Serbia. I mean, Serbia isn't part of the EU, but Belgrade's becoming a huge hotspot for innovation. I think Tallinn has the most startups per capita. So I think, a lot of the times we think about Berlin, London, Amsterdam, Paris, but there's some really exciting, things in across multiple industries and in cities within Eastern Europe that are really kind of on the uptrend.
Well, and the innovation happens in different ways from the large metro centers than from the other smaller places. Do you think that do you think one does a better job than the other? Or are they just different?
I think they're just different, and I think even just. It's, I mean, going back to this point that each market is different, I think it's important that each market in Europe has a hub for fintech innovation, and they're focusing on the consumers within that market, because me as a consumer in Germany is completely different from a consumer in France, which is completely different from how Norwegians are, how they view financial service providers and banks and how they're engaging. So a really funny story. So in Germany, cash is still king or queen. And in Berlin, especially. So, I mean, you come to Berlin and you always have to have cash on you. It's like, rarely can you go to a place where they accept cards. And it's tied to this German mindset where Germans, and I mean, not all Germans, but a lot of Germans, they don't like using their bank cards because they don't want the bank knowing where they're spending their money. So, they're they're hesitant to use the cards. And also, you know, there's a lot of like smaller merchants in Germany, and I don't think they're necessarily like educated around accepting payments. So a lot of them still think that cash is more expensive than accepting cards. And there was a Scandinavian bank that I work with that was in Berlin, and I took them out to dinner, and it was my favorite restaurant. It was really good. And I totally forgot to tell them that this restaurant doesn't accept cards. And when the bill came, they didn't know what to do. It was like they hadn't used an ATM in years, and they were like, oh, you know, can we get an invoice? What do we do? How do we do this? And, you know, it was like 30 minutes of kind of, okay, how are we actually going to pay the bill? But it was just, I mean, it was just so funny, because that was one of like, you know, the truest experiences of how consumers are so different in each of the markets here.
Well, you've written a lot about that and done a lot in your work around those kind of cultural nuances. Do you think that's a big hurdle for somebody to really hit scale pan-Europe or even global? I mean, we haven't seen that yet, right? You've talked about N26 and Monzo and Hello Bank and others expanding, but those cultural nuances do make a big difference, don't they?
I think so. I mean, I think Revolut and TransferWise are two that spring to mind that, you know, right, have a presence in the majority of markets. But again, I mean, I think this is more, it's almost there in a niche of this kind of like, you know, the market for traveling and for international payments and this payments where, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm Megan living in Germany and I'm going abroad to Kenya, or, you know, someone in Bulgaria or in, say, Austria, they're still going to kind of have the same challenges as I will, kind of prepping for that trip. How do I spend money on that trip? But in terms of kind of, I think, you know, the day-to-day banking components and, you know, even in the SME space, I think each market is just different enough where it's really hard to kind of get that one size fits all model from kind of the B2C aspect. I mean, from, you know, B2B fintechs, I think they're in a better position to kind of, you know, have that one size fits all European product than B2C for sure.
Well, and let's talk about those small businesses, those SMEs. Yes. What's happening in the European space? Because I feel like we have a long way to go in the U.S. Around really coming up with some good solutions for that. But I think we're seeing some pretty interesting things come out of various parts of Europe. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the SME segment was interesting kind of before we saw these waves of challenger banks and fintechs helping, because before it was either, you know, the traditional banks would either offer a, you know, a solopreneur or a smaller size business, essentially like the consumer banking platform. So there was nothing that made this special or tailored to the needs of a solopreneur and SME. And then they would have a separate kind of like mid-sized market or corporate banking platform. And what we're seeing really across the board in Europe are challenger banks and fintechs that are really focusing on creating products and services that are 100% tailored for a particular type of business. So, for example, in Germany, I mentioned Contis and Penta. So Contis is a mobile-only bank that's focused on solopreneurs. So, you know, all the nuances and really bureaucratic things that solopreneurs have to do here in Germany, they have made that kind of like the forefront of their product and service development. And then you have Penta, which is focusing more on the medium-sized companies. So in Germany, it's like the GmbHs or the UGs, which are kind of two aspects of a limited company. They have, you know, their day-to-day and tax requirements and reporting requirements are completely different to the solopreneur. And, you know, when you look at those banks, it's like they're so different but the kind of the sameness is that they've really just 100% focused on the needs of that type of business owner. And, you know, I know there's a whole lot of SME banks and propositions coming out of France, and there's, you know, Coconut in the UK, and a lot of smart kind of cash flow analysis and accounting platforms such as Fluidly that, again, are just, you know, focusing on a particular segment. One interesting thing we're kind of seeing in Europe, so I just saw that Konto, which is a French SME bank, has announced they're launching in Germany. And Penta, at the back end of last year, announced that they were launching in Italy. So I think, you know, in the next few years, we'll see some of these successful SME platforms that have really kind of nailed their home market look to markets that, you know, are similar and kind of makeup in terms of, you know, the how many large businesses versus solopreneurs there are, and, you know, are the kind of VAT and tax requirements similar. So, I mean, that's super exciting.
Oh, it is. So, Megan, thanks for joining us this week. It's been great. You can hear Megan on our Breaking Banks Europe podcast. And how else can people learn more about your work?
Yeah, so they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @digital_mags with two S's, M-A-G-S-S. Or they can go to my website, meganjohnson.io.
That's Megan, M-E-A-G-H-A-N. Johnson, the way you'd normally spell it. J-O-H-N-S-O-N. Right?
Yeah, it's confusing.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.